the details of the story get amplified as the time goes on. Now, the earliest story is the story in Mark. And in Mark it says that at the time of Jesus' apprehension in the garden, that somebody took a sword and cut off the ear of the servant of the high priest. Then in Matthew, it says that Peter took the sword and cut off the ear of the servant. And in Luke, it says that it was Peter who took the sword and cut off the right ear of the man. And then in John, it says, Peter took the sword and cut off the right ear, and the man's name was Malchus. So from point to point to point, and those are texts that Matthew would have been available, or would have known about Mark's text, and Luke would have known about Matthew's text. They would have known about those texts. And so what they're doing is they're adding to it. When you study literature, the oldest text is always the shortest one. Almost no one cuts something out. They'll add to it. So the longer the text is, the older it is. I mean, the newer it is. The shorter the text is, the older it is. So in Matthew, we've got the ear of the servant being cut off. Now, if you cut off the right ear of somebody, that means you've got to be left-handed. That's your right ear, correct?
Yep.
So if I'm going to cut it off, I'm going to have to do it that way. I'm not going to do it this way. I'll cut your nose off if I do it this way.
Right.
So if the right ear is the one that is cut off, then the person who wielded the sword had to be left-handed. So they say Peter was left-handed. You take it for what it's worth. Okay, now Jesus is hauled before the Sanhedrin, the court. Matthew is the only gospel that tells us that the high priest's name was Caiaphas. Mark, Luke, and John, they refer to the high priest, but they don't give his name. Sanhedrin comes from a Greek word that means council. And it was applied to the various councils that had judicial work to do among the Jews in Palestine, which was overseen by the Romans. So it was a kind of internal legal machinery that the Romans allowed. Remember, the Sanhedrin, the council, could not condemn to death. They had to go to the governor to have that done. The Sanhedrin was comprised of 70 men, plus the high priest, and he served as its chairperson. And the members of the Sanhedrin came from the chief priests and the elders. And there is no record really of how they were chosen. So it might have been according to the leading families that these 70 people were chosen. Now, this is not the same as the Old Testament talks about the ancients, you know, the ancient leaders of the people. This is not what they're talking about. They're talking about a judicial vehicle. It would hear cases that would be brought before it. The Sanhedrin was abolished by the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. After 70 AD, there was no Sanhedrin because there was no temple, there was no high priesthood. All of that came crashing down. We're told that Nicodemus, who Jesus speaks with in the in St. John's Gospel, was a member of the Sanhedrin. And we're told that Joseph of Arimathea, who comes to help with the burial of Jesus, was a member of the Sanhedrin. Now, a court session in the middle of the night on a major Jewish feast where the high priest encourages false witnesses and then intervenes to tell the judges that the person is guilty, and where the judges themselves spit on the prisoner, slap him, and slap him, violates absolutely every procedure that one would find for the Jewish court. So clearly it is a trumped up effort. We have a legal procedure taking place on the night of Passover in which the chief priest is active and in which he plays a part, not as a judge, but plays a part in arranging for false witnesses. It's in the middle of this cross-examination going back and forth that we're told that the chief priest rose and he tore his garments and he said, "We have heard the blasphemy. What more do we need to hear?" The tearing of the garments is associated with intense grief. So we're told that when Absalom, the son of David, was killed, that what David did is he ripped his garments, he tore his garments as a sign of complete grief. Now, clearly this is a charade. I mean, there's no grief that these people are experiencing. It's done for a publicity thing. So he tears his garments. And while Jesus is being interrogated in the court, Peter is being interrogated in the courtyard. And the elders are wrestling with the money that Judas brings back. So you've got three scenes going. Jesus with the Sanhedrin, Peter in the courtyard, and Judas and the chief priest and the temple priests in the temple treasury. And those stories go back and forth. They're sandwiched in with each other, and that's what they're called. They're called the sandwich. You know, and it's not only an ancient, but it's a modern way of writing. You write about an event that's occurring, and then you write about an event that's occurring at the same time, but someplace else. It's what I call meanwhile back at the ranch, you know, kind of writing. And that's what we have. We have the money is brought back, the 30 pieces of silver are brought back, and they don't know what to do with it. This is blood money. This is money that has been paid for the purchase of someone. We bought a human being with this money. We just can't put it back in the treasury. We've got to do something. Not only did we buy a human being, but we bought a human being so that that person might be executed. This is money for a corpse. And so what they did is they decided that they would put the money into the purchase of a cemetery for indigent people who had, you know, no resources, you know, a potter's field. There used to be, you know, turn of the century, there used to be, it would not be uncommon that a portion of the cemetery, and usually these were church cemeteries, so they're right outside the church building, but a portion of the cemetery would be called the potter's field. And so if you had a stranger who died, or if you had someone passing through who died, that there was a place to bury that person. And that person didn't have to buy a grave. That the community took care of the stranger, of the wanderer. So what they did was they purchased a field. then St. Matthew simply says that following the giving back of the money, just simply says that he went out, he wept, and he hanged himself. In Luke's gospel, we have the words, he repented and then hanged himself. Now, it's interesting that, at least in one of the gospels, we're told that Judas repented, that Judas was sorry. And clearly that's the attitude that you find as he brings the money back. I've done something that I'm sorry about. So Judas repents. There's nothing in the gospel that says Peter ever repented. Jesus has to drag repentance out of Peter on the shore of the lake. Peter, do you love me? Yes, Lord, I love you. Three times. And then he felt embarrassed because he remembered he had denied Jesus three times, and now Jesus was asking him to affirm his love for him. Well, again, that's neither here nor there. Point is that someday I would like to hear someone preach a sermon on Good Friday about the repentance of Judas. That'd be a pretty interesting piece, huh? All right. Any questions that people have?
Okay, one question. This is leaking ahead.
Yep.
At the crucifixion, the tearing of the garments in the temple, and you're talking about the tearing of the garments here. Was that a sign of grief then, or does that have a different symbolic?
It was the tearing of the veil, that covered the place where the Ark of the Covenant was. Mm-hmm. And so in one of the documents, it says that at the moment of his death, the veil of the temple was torn in two. The image being the Old Testament is over. That era is done. The fulfillment has happened. There are those who say that it was a very ornate veil. And it was artistic in the sense that there were images on it, and images that were made with very precious materials, and that the images were the images of the zodiac. So they were the images of all of life, of all of creation, of all of existence. And so it is all of existence, if you will, that announces or that is the entryway into the Holy of Holies and into the Ark of the Covenant. So that was that veil that came down. Others say there were a succession of veils that you went through. Now remember, the temple was destroyed in 70 AD, so all we've got is we've got writings from people who are pre-Jesus about descriptions. About descriptions of what was there. Yes?
Also, with that, in the temple when the curtain was torn, wasn't there in the Old Testament only the high priest could go in there once a year?
Correct.
And then that symbolism is once Christ died, God's love and presence was there for all of us.
That's right.
It's not just for the higher ups.
Once a year, the high priest could go into the Holy of Holies behind the veil, and this was on the feast of what you and I know as Yom Kippur. It was the Feast of Atonement. And so what would be done is that the congregation and the high priest would pray for God's mercy and God's forgiveness. And then once again an animal is used, this time as a goat. And what happens is the goat is brought into the space, and the high priest puts his hands on top of the goat and transmits the sins of the people into the goat, and then the goat is driven out into the wilderness. Whence comes our term scapegoat? Oh. The scapegoat. Okay, Anything else? Yes?
So who was Matthew writing for, and when did he, who was Matthew, what was his?
Matthew was.
And when did he write?
Okay, Matthew wrote probably around 80 AD. His audience was probably in the area of Syria, and it was a mixed audience of Gentile Christians and Jewish Christians. And it's an audience in which there was tension between the two groups. So what Matthew is trying to do is to, for the Jewish Christians, he's trying to show that Jesus does not throw away anything of the law. He fulfills the law. For the Gentiles, he tries to show that Jesus went beyond Israel in his calling of people into salvation. So that he had to walk between these two groups. But that was kind of his audience. Matthew is also, because he's dealing with a mixed audience, if you will, and an audience that not all would share the same background. The Gentile Christians would not have the Jewish background, the Jewish Christians would not have he had to become rather explicit in announcing what the faith was about. So Matthew, from the very beginning, is called the catechetical gospel. That if you want to study the Christian faith, you read Matthew first. So Matthew has five very large teachings of Jesus, not the least being the first one, the Sermon on the Mount. So there are all these teachings in which, in very short snippets, truths are told. And, if you will, that's the catechetical piece of it, that we study the truths there. He also needs to show how Jesus is, for the Jewish Christians, how Jesus is the fulfillment of all that God had planned. And that's why the genealogy begins, the book. So he's got to start with Abraham and show that Jesus eventually traces his ancestry back to Abraham. As I mentioned the last time we gathered, the early church does something that none of us would ever think of doing. I mean, if someone came to us and said, I really want to study what it is to be a Christian, we probably wouldn't begin with the genealogy of Jesus. But that's what the early church did. The early church told the story of each one of those Old Testament characters and linked that story, one after another, up to the birth of the Lord. And then once you've linked that story, in a sense, you've rehearsed the whole Old Testament. And you say, now this is fulfilled in Jesus. So that's the audience or the purpose. Anything else? Following the Jewish trial in the Sanhedrin, there's the Roman trial. Jesus is abandoned and deserted by his friends. He's surrounded by his enemies. And he's drawn before the governor, who has the power to condemn him. Jesus is self-possessed. Jesus remains silent. And the governor is unnerved and defensive. The Jewish court had sought an acknowledgement of messiahship, and despite Jesus' reply, seized upon this issue as a means to bring the case to the governor. The matter was real simple. If this man is the Messiah, then this man is a king, and therefore is a rival to Caesar. And so we bring him before the governor. Insurgent activity always posed a problem for the Romans during a holiday. You've got all kinds of people who flocked into the city for Passover, and the last thing they're going to want is an insurgency They are just not going to tolerate that. So anything that smacks of initiating a riot, they're going to put down. And that's really what the argument for Jesus was that his very presence will initiate some disturbance. Remember, it was the high priest who said before all of this began, as they were plotting, he said, it's expedient that one person die, that the nation be saved. We don't want a riot. We don't want these people to, you know, to do something that's going to really bring the Romans down upon us. It's no big deal. So one person's going to die. Go for it. It's expedient that one person die, that the nation be saved. Then, of course, the text of the author says, little did he realize that what he was doing was prophesying that by the death of Jesus, the nation would be saved. Then we have that curious practice that occurred in which Barabbas is a person in prison, had been an insurrectionist, had been a part of a riotous mob, and that as part of the holiday spirit, the governor was always willing to release a prisoner, whoever the people wanted, and so he puts before them Barabbas, feeling that there's a greater chance they're going to ask for Barabbas and leave Jesus alone, because Barabbas is a well-known illegal, a violator of good order. All four evangelists describe this custom. In Matthew, the Barabbas story is interrupted by a dream of Pilate's wife. She has a cameo appearance here. She comes in the middle of the trial, and she calls her husband off to the side and says, Pilate, let it go. Just leave it. This is not something you want to get your feet into. I've had a dream about this man, and it's not going to end well. She tries to encourage him not to pursue. Of course, he doesn't do that. He pursues. Isn't it fascinating that of all the figures in the story of Jesus, when we profess the creed, the only person in the public life of Jesus we speak of is Pilate. No one of the apostles. He suffered under Pontius Pilate, was crucified, died, and was buried. To me, that's a really curious thing, that for 2,000 years, that man's name has been proclaimed in church day after day, week after week, year after year, as if he were, you know, a central figure. And he isn't a central figure in the story. He has a role to play. Now, he's not a very nice person to begin with. He's a time-saving political figure. He at one point had been the procurator, the governor of a very large territory, and because of his inability to handle it, he was reduced to being the governor of this very small little Palestinian territory. So he doesn't have a huge reputation. And he can be a fairly vicious individual. He can be a fairly resentful individual. But he's the one on whose shoulders rests the opportunity to make the decision that this person is to be executed. Except he doesn't. He doesn't make the decision. He hands it back to them. Take him and do with him whatever you want to do. I'm not going to have anything to do with him. Now, why do you assume Pilate is portrayed as a fairly, not a neutral figure, but he's not the bad guy either. he says, I don't find any problem with this man. You know, I don't see what you're talking about. He doesn't appear to me to be deserving of this kind of penalty. Well, remember what's going on. The church is under tremendous persecution from the Romans. And so the last thing the church is going to want to do is to be seen as anti-Roman. So what you're going to do is you're going to give not a whitewash, but a beige wash to Pilate. And you're going to make the chief priests and the elders the absolute enemy, the bad guys, which some say is the beginning of anti-Semitism in the church. That because you can make the chief priests the enemy, the one who is responsible for the death of Jesus, and the chief priests who have the crowd yell, may his blood be upon us and all our children. You know, for all time, we accept his blood. When you can do that, you take Pilate off the hook, and you put the Jews on the hook. And some would say that that is the foundational stone for the building up of anti-Semitism. Now, some people find it really hard to read those passages, especially in John's Gospel. John refers often to the Jews. And when he says the Jews, he really means the enemies of Jesus. He doesn't mean all Jews. He means the authority or the Pharisees or the scribes. He means those leadership people. He calls them the Jews. Well, some people find it really hard to say that because they feel it's an anti-Semitic statement. And I think that's really too bad because it is what it is. And we need to face the fact that maybe through our religious history from the very beginning, there was an anti-Semitic strain that was present. And so it seems inappropriate to water that down. It's just there and it needs to be acknowledged, and then we go on. It's not the same thing that happens today, but it did have a history. And so the hatred of Jews is linked with the crucifixion and death of Jesus. After all, he is the King of the Jews. That is what the title is. Pilate writes that title. Pilate says, I'll fix you. You want this guy done in, you want him killed, I'll tell him who he is. He's not this bandit, he's not this riotous person, he is your king. And so he puts the sign over Jesus' head, this is the King of the Jews. And the chief priests and the elders come and say, take down that sign. He's not the King of the Jews. And Pilate just smiles and says, what I have written, I've written. So get with it. It's going to stay this way. And to that extent, again, we don't have a crucifix in here, but on any crucifix that shows the suffering Jesus, you have that sign on top. It looks like I-N-R-I, but it's really J-N-R-J. The I and the J are the same. So it says, Jesus of Nazareth, King Rex Judaeorum of the Jews. Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. That's what Pilate wrote on the sign. And we're told in John's Gospel that it was written in three languages. So that whoever passed by would be able to read it. It was a trilingual sign. Okay, it's 11 o'clock.